This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about efforts to fix a dysfunctional state agency that so many depend upon for survival.
This is unacceptable. There's no other way to describe the audits that came out but being damning. They are just damning of the situation.
Also, we'll learn more about digital connectivity on the Central Coast.
And the Broadband Consortium's goal is, how can we do things? How can we help set policy? How can we set the direction of a community so that there is an opportunity to have more competition?
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 8th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. For months, there's been a rising tidal wave of condemnation against California's Employment Development Department, or the EDD, the state agency responsible for processing unemployment claims. When it was discovered in November that thousands of prison inmates had accessed benefits fraudulently, Central Coast Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham said, quote, "Just when we thought EDD couldn't be more flawed, they have found another way to surprise us," end quote. Now, we speak with Central Coast State Senator John Laird about the EDD and the latest on the effort to fix the dysfunctional agency. Here's Laird speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart.
When I was a candidate, you know, I made it through the March primary, and then I immediately was locked down with the rest of California because of COVID. And immediately, even though I'm not holding office, I'm hearing from all these friends of mine and supporters that they're having incredible problems with the Employment Development Department, EDD. And it goes across the board. The site crashed, they would call over and over and over again, sometimes hundreds of times, and never get an answer. They couldn't get an application taken in. I was hooking them up with people I knew in the system, and it was just really bad. It was really clear that it was not meeting the needs of people, and that actually people were in economic distress, and this was just making it worse. And then I get elected in November, and I take office, and everybody descends on me. We have had special trainings on this. The entire district staff is almost devoted totally to EDD. And if I thought the stories were bad, they were just worse. And there was a professor in my district that was owed an amazing amount of money. It was not paid. She was living in her car. The car was about to be repossessed. There was somebody else that was having trouble where they weren't getting the money, and the phone and the mail and everything related to even being able to find out about it was about to be cut off. Somebody was overpaid and they were about to get at them, and they paid the money back and they never cashed the check. You just went down, and there was one thing after another. And there's one that's just becoming aware to people now, which is that there were so many people that had their identity stolen, and the stolen identity was used to be able to access benefits. And the only way people are finding out that their identity was stolen is they're starting to get W-2s. For tax money they owe on the money that was stolen that they didn't even know happened. And this is completely separate from the fact that when they thought in EDD there was massive fraud, they froze people's accounts. And so they froze the accounts of many people on the perception of fraud who are genuinely and legitimately collecting benefits from EDD. And so what's happened here is a disaster, and they're estimating there's problems with the accounts of 800,000 Californians. And so this is just going to take monumental fixing. And while legislation was introduced to do certain things yesterday, a lot of this is administrative. They have the tools to do this. They don't need further legislation, but the program isn't being administered correctly. And one of the issues that's come up is some people want to make it about the current governor. And yet this happened in the great recession meltdown in 2009 and 2010. There was an audit in 2011, and then those recommendations were not implemented. And now the same things are happening 10 years later. So this is something that has cut across governorships of three governors of different parties. And the question is how are we going to fix it now? Because EDD was just not equipped for the volume that descended on it when the pandemic started and the economic meltdown followed.
Okay. And why, what is it particularly about this department that's just so messed up? What is it about it?
I think there are many things. The process is antiquated for doing it. But another major thing is they were just not equipped for the volumes in a catastrophic event like this. So suddenly with antiquated systems, antiquated call systems, antiquated online systems, they were descended on by millions of people, which is many more than they could accommodate in any traditional time. And they were just not ready. They had no recession plan, because in this field, they refer to having a recession plan. Like, what happens if the economy melts down suddenly and the whole world descends on you for services and there's real need? How do you adjust your level of service? How do you recruit people and have them in to meet the demand in a timely fashion? Because this is not about something random. This is about people that are hanging by a thread with their rent or their car or their phone or just basic food and healthcare. And they need money to patch them through. And when people are living EDD check to EDD check, they have to actually get the check. And that is part of the problem that was happening here.
So a bunch of bills were introduced yesterday, but legislation takes a long time. What about the person who didn't get their check yesterday? Like, how is it going to be fixed in your mind?
Well, the Joint Audit Committee had the first hearing on these audits earlier this week. And the current director of the department came, took responsibility, pledged to do all these emergency actions, but I think they're in such a hole that it's going to be really hard to dig out. There was one statistic they tossed out that they have responded to 40%, or they are on top of 40%. Well, that's 60% they're not on top of, if that's happening. And so I think the question is yes, is there legislation needed to force the situation? But it might be that this is a budget situation. Do we have to do some emergency action to get them positions to do the volume of work that is necessary here in short order? And I was a cabinet secretary for 8 years under Jerry Brown. And we had, in the middle of that, was the DMV crisis. It was an all hands on deck thing. All of us in each cabinet department got a direction, and we had to provide extra staff members over to the DMV. And it was an administrative wide effort. And I think Governor Newsom is doing that now, where he's trying to reach into different departments and really see if they can't get people to EDD to try to bail out of this situation.
Okay, got it. And for, you know, there's going to be a lot of people listening to this that totally understand everything you're talking about. But there's also people that haven't lost their job, haven't applied for EDD. And why should they care that this is happening?
Well, actually, they should care, because a lot of their jobs depend on people getting money to do some of the things that they work in. And I would suspect that almost anybody is related to somebody in this situation, because this hits so across the economy and so across California that almost everybody has friends, family members, or people that patronize their business. I mean, if you're in a grocery store, these are people that can't come in. If you're in a gas station, these are people that can't buy the gas. You just go through every other sector of the economy. And this is really key to moving it along. So I think this is a concern for all of us because every, and particularly now with COVID, you want people to be protected economically so they don't have to interact with others unnecessarily. And sometimes when people are struggling for money and have no income, that forces them to do things at the time of a pandemic that might not be as safe as they can't afford to just stay home the way some people can right now. So this is something that everybody should care about.
Okay, and finally, what can people do about this? Is there anything the normal citizen can do to help make this, you know, to fix the EDD?
I think that it's really going to be the state administration that has to do it, but I think that everybody can weigh in and say they're in favor of it, whether it's calling their legislators or writing letters to the editor or just saying this. This is unacceptable. I mean, my comments in the hearing earlier is there's no other way to describe the audits that came out but being damning. They are just damning of the situation. And so I think we need to know that everybody supports these general directions and wants to get this fixed. And I have a feeling that that doesn't take rocket science to guess that that's where the general public is right now.
That was Central Coast State Senator John Laird speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. As a society, we've known for months that essential workers are more at risk of contracting COVID-19 than others. A new research paper out of UC San Francisco examines the risk of death among these workers, and it suggests that the death toll due to COVID is likely much higher than official counts. KVPR's Carrie Klein spoke with Yehung Chen, an epidemiologist at UCSF and the primary author of the study, about his team's research.
So among Californians of working age, 18 to 65 years of age, we estimate that roughly 10,000 more people died than we would have expected had the pandemic not occurred. That's only from March through October, and that represents a 22% increase. In other words, deaths were 22% higher than we would have expected had the pandemic not occurred. The way we did this was we basically looked at older data and we projected out what we would have expected to see had the pandemic not occurred.
Yeah, that's pretty tremendous. And so, okay, so those are the numbers that, you know, those are, that maybe it was a starting point perhaps, but then you humanize those numbers by, as you said, examining these excess deaths by occupation and by race and ethnicity. And in some ways, perhaps those findings were not all that surprising. You know, who did you find appears to have, suffered the highest mortality rates last year?
Workers among the food and agricultural industries, that was a big one. They saw a relative increase of 39%. We also saw large increases among workers in transportation and logistics workers. That would be things like delivery, also large increases in facilities that would include stuff like janitorial services and construction.
And then by looking at these excess deaths by race and ethnicity, too, the highest impacts appear to have been among people of color.
The greatest rises have been among Latinos and Blacks. And that's something that we've seen with other studies we've worked on, and other people have reported similar things. And it's, you know, it's certainly alarming. It's certainly one of those things that when we first started working on this, we expected to see, but I certainly didn't expect to see such big differences.
But then, you know, there was at least one small surprise. I mean, if you talk about the mortality rate among the health and emergency sector.
Yeah, so that was an interesting one. I think, so the relative increase we saw there was about 20%, which is about in line with what we see overall for working individuals. And that was a little surprising. I imagine many of your listeners may have anticipated seeing a greater increase there. And our interpretation is that it's indicative of workplace protections that are in place in hospitals. I don't want to diminish the tremendous sacrifice that healthcare workers take and the risks that they face. And it's also not to diminish the horror stories that we've heard about, for example, lack of masks or scarcity of masks in hospitals, particularly early in the pandemic. But our interpretation of that finding of the 20% relative increase among healthcare workers compared to, let's say, a 40% relative increase among food and agriculture is that among healthcare settings, we tend to know that there are strong protections in place.
And so why are all of these people dying? Can we assume that all of these deaths, is there a way of knowing whether all these deaths are related to COVID?
It's a great question. And we have looked at that. And I mean, the short answer is that a large proportion of this is officially accountable to COVID. There's also another portion that we know and imagine to be unrecorded COVID. We know that there are, and we've heard this from physicians and anecdotally, and there's other evidence for that, that oftentimes COVID deaths aren't officially recorded as such. So that's part of the story as well. There's certainly other things going on, and there have been concerns about increases in non-COVID deaths. But our overall theory about this is that it's primarily COVID deaths.
So I think it became apparent, you know, relatively early on in the pandemic that frontline workers were especially vulnerable to this virus. Communities of color were especially mm-hmm. vulnerable to this virus. You know, what do you think is the value of a study like this that confirms, in a way, you know, what in some ways we already knew?
It's a really interesting question because as we worked on this, I think we struggled with how valuable this might be to people. I think we had a sense that this was important, but at the same time, we also had a sense of what you're pointing to, which is that don't we already know this, right? And in truth, the actual quantitative data on this has been pretty limited. And so the primary evidence on this sort of stuff has been documented instances of outbreaks or knowledge about lack of protections in workplaces or simply anecdotal evidence. Certainly, I think among people who work in these industries, among people who have unfortunately lost loved ones who work in these industries, I think these results are not very surprising. But what we saw actually when we posted this a couple of weeks ago was really that it really took off, and there's been this huge outpouring of reaction I don't want to say support, but there's been a lot of people who've reached out to us and are really grateful, I think, for this information. And I think it speaks to the prior lack of quantitative data on this.
And so quantitative data might actually allow for more solid steps forward to try and, you know, curb the virus in certain ways, perhaps.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're hopeful that this will lead to action on multiple fronts, and certainly workplace protections and also vaccination as well. That it's one thing to document outbreaks, but I think having data that are for the entire state and across multiple industries, I think is valuable. And keep in mind, especially that a lot of the information out there prior to this, or a lot of the conversation prior to this has been on the healthcare workers, which is deserved. But I think we are proud of the fact that we are drawing attention, at least in a quantitative scientific way, to what's going on, for example, among the food and agricultural workers. We've been seeing some action this week, for example, with local actions on hero pay, of increasing pay for workers by the hour during the pandemic. There's ongoing conversations about the Cal OSHA regulations that were put into place in response to the pandemic. You know, we're glad to be part of this conversation and to provide information that can guide these decisions. And similarly with vaccination, I think you know, that's this whole vaccination question is controversial, and it's unavoidably controversial. You know, the 65 plus model that the state has adopted and is a plan that really does make a lot of sense in many ways. And the reason being that most people who die from COVID are older individuals. That being said, I do think it's worth looking at other groups, especially because we know it will take a long time to vaccinate people who are 65 years and older. And I think particularly with essential workers, some things to think about are that essential workers tend to be younger and that they have a long life potentially ahead of them. It's also important to think about this whole idea of why we call them essential in the first place, which is that we view them as being essential to our society and essential to our economy. So if you think about food and agricultural workers, if you look at agriculture specifically, which I know is important to the Central Valley, agriculture this industry doesn't just put food onto the plates of Californians. It's providing food for the nation and really people all over the world. And so I think these workers have a really important, you know, place to play, and that needs to be taken into account in this conversation about vaccination. I mean, a third area to look at here with essential workers is the racial element. We know, for example, that Latinos make up a large proportion of agricultural workers. When you look at the 65 plus plan, we know that the age distribution of COVID deaths actually depends on race. And so you're actually, the coverage of the 65 plus plan doesn't work quite as well by race, because we know that Latinos and Blacks, the deaths are occurring at younger ages.
Right. Well, Yehung Chen, epidemiologist at UC San Francisco, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That was KVPR's Carrie Klein with that interview. Monterey County's Big Sur community faces more hardship now that a section of Highway 1 is yet again closed after a landslide. This comes after a major wildfire last summer, January's storm and debris flow, and the ongoing pandemic. KAZU's Erica Mahoney has more.
Kirk Gaffel sits in his office at Nepenthe in Big Sur. He's general manager of the restaurant, which is perched on a cliffside with spectacular views of the churning blue waters of the Pacific Ocean.
Very reminiscent of something one might find in a Mediterranean climate.
Over Zoom, he tells me the sun is shining there, a stark contrast to last week's stormy skies. But the fallout from that intense rain and windstorm isn't going away anytime soon. A chunk of Highway 1 washed out roughly 15 miles south of Nepenthe, making the well-known coastal road trip between Los Angeles and San Francisco impossible. Gaffel says that
is only adding, you know, headwinds to our recovery.
Gaffel is also president of the Big Sur Chamber of Commerce. He expects a more extreme impact on businesses south of the closure and a moderate impact on those north, where Nepenthe and the town of Big Sur are located. He says 2/3 of their customers come from the north and then return that way. The last few years have been particularly challenging in Big Sur. There was the Soberanes fire in 2016, a bridge collapse, and massive mudslide that landlocked businesses and residents in 2017. And then,
you know, 2020, we get COVID and, of course, the Dolan fire and now this road failure. It's really going to test the financial resources of the business owners and our employees.
He's optimistic the economy will recover this year. As for the highway closure, that poses another uncertain outlook. Caltrans is still assessing the damage. Kevin Drabinski with Caltrans likens the repair to a major renovation.
If you could imagine taking your kitchen down to the studs, and you'd have to make choices on cabinets, lighting, plumbing, utilities, flooring, then you'd be able to develop a budget for that.
And a timeline. The work is complicated. The rainstorm set off a debris flow from the burn scar of last summer's Dolan fire, sending water, tree trunks, and boulders down the hillside. It overwhelmed the drainage infrastructure at the site, washing out the highway. Now there's a 150-foot chasm. Both lanes are gone. It looks like someone used their hand to dig into a chocolate cake. Local emergency responders are also affected. Marcus Foster is a captain with Big Sur Fire, a volunteer organization that covers a 60-mile stretch of the coastline. He says it could take an ambulance extra time to reach someone south of the highway closure.
Whether it's a traffic accident, a cliff rescue, we get a lot of hang gliders up there in that area. We get surfers.
Big Sur Fire's main station and most personnel live north of the closure. So the team has been shuttling all the way around to bring more equipment down to their other station on the South Coast. Foster says they will likely be relying on other agencies for assistance if something happens in that remote area. Despite the challenges, he says living in Big Sur is worth it.
I love this area. I love this community. Everybody knows everybody and will help out neighbors.
Foster added, it's just an incredible life, but it's a hard life sometimes. Erica Mahoney, KAZU News.
January marked the midpoint in Gavin Newsom's term as California's governor. The moment arrives as he is facing a recall effort that is gaining steam and could make it to the ballot. Cap Radio's politics reporter Nicole Nixon had this look at who's behind the recall and whether it could actually succeed.
Diana Chokan is posted up in the parking lot of a grocery store in Citrus Heights, a suburb about 20 minutes north of Sacramento. She's wearing a neon green vest, and her car is draped with an enormous banner that reads, Recall Gavin Newsom.
I'm a hairstylist. When my salon got shut down, I had a lot of time on my hands.
The 42-year-old comes here 3 days a week to gather signatures for a petition to get Newsom recalled.
I got involved because it was disturbing to see all the businesses closing.
Chokan actually carries a list of reasons she thinks Newsom should get the boot. Pandemic shutdowns are at the top, but there's a lot more.
We have the highest gas tax in the nation, the highest homelessness in the nation. He's promoting fear. Gavin Newsom goes to the French Laundry and eats without a mask.
On any given day, there are dozens, maybe hundreds of tables like hers up and down California. Organizers say they've collected over 1 million signatures. But if they want to get a recall on the ballot, they'll need to get about 1 million more in the next 6 weeks. For a governor facing the very real threat of a recall election, Newsom has a high approval rating, 58%, according to the most recent Public Policy Institute of California survey. That's largely because Democrats have given the governor high marks throughout the pandemic, says Mark Baldessari. He's with the PPIC.
People are very polarized in terms of how they think about their leaders. So you're going to find people who have very strong feelings for and against this governor.
Baldessari says there are big differences between this recall effort and the 2003 recall of former Democratic Governor Gray Davis. Democrats did not have such a tight hold on the state back then, and Davis's approval sunk to a record low of 24% in the months before his ouster. There haven't been voters surveyed since the most recent stay-at-home orders or the French Laundry incident when Newsom was photographed dining with a group of lobbyists at the exclusive Napa Valley restaurant. But the most recent surveys show Democratic voters still continue to support Newsom, while Republicans disapprove.
Voters' biggest cue will always be partisanship, as much as people don't want to admit that.
Renee Van Vechten is a political science professor at the University of Redlands. She says, while Newsom is clinging to the good graces of most California voters, there's a lot riding on the next few weeks, including the all-important COVID-19 vaccine distribution.
It is do-or-die time for the governor, because he does face the very real possibility of a recall election.
If the recall does qualify for the ballot, an election would likely be later this summer. And Van Vechten says Newsom shouldn't rely too heavily on his base to carry him through.
He's on a mountain, and he's driving around on a very narrow road. Could he go off the cliff at any time? It's possible. It just one little turn of the wheel, and he's over the hill. That is what a French Laundry incident represents.
And she says voters may not have the appetite for another scandal. In Sacramento, I'm Nicole Nixon.
The campaign to recall Governor Newsom recently shared a false claim that Facebook tried to, quote, shut down recall efforts. PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols and Cap Radio anchor Mike Haggerty go over the story.
The effort to recall Newsom's been gaining momentum. So what exactly did it say about Facebook shutting down the recall?
Well, the recall campaign spread some false information through its Instagram account. It shared a blog post that said Facebook was trying to shut down the recall effort by not allowing it to place ads on its platform. We found that's just a really big distortion of what happened. In reality, Facebook announced last fall that it would stop accepting all political ads, regardless of party affiliation, and its goal was to curb the spread of misinformation. There's no evidence that the Newsom recall campaign was singled out. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg talked about the change last September on CBS.
One of the new policies that we're announcing is we're going to block new political and issue ads in the last week of the campaign.
Facebook went on to extend that policy into December. It then made an exception for the U.S. Senate runoffs in Georgia before resuming its ban on political ads in January.
So no political campaigns can buy ads on Facebook right now. But what else can they do on the platform?
In the case of the recall campaign, they can do a lot of things. They have a strong presence on Facebook. That includes a public group where more than 20,000 members share information about upcoming recall drives. And they have another 16,000 followers on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook.
How did you rate the claim that Facebook tried to shut down the campaign?
We rated that false.
Our national partner, PolitiFact, looked at a claim on social media this week involving House Speaker and California Democrat Nancy Pelosi and Tesla, right?
Yes, they looked at an image shared on Facebook that claims Pelosi bought more than $1 million in Tesla stock. Now, Tesla is the electric car maker based in California. And this claim says Pelosi made the purchase the day before President Joe Biden signed an order for all federal vehicles to be electric. It strongly implies that she was trying to profit from inside information about new government policies.
And what did PolitiFact find?
Well, they found a few problems with this claim. Pelosi's husband did buy stock options in Tesla for up to $1 million. But that was back in December and not the day Biden signed his order. Speaker Pelosi did disclose the purchase as required by law. PolitiFact also found that Biden's order just asks federal agencies to move towards zero emission vehicles. It doesn't actually require them to purchase electric vehicles. And I think most importantly, they also pointed out Biden made it clear throughout his campaign for president that he wanted the federal fleet to move in this direction, so that goal is really no secret. Biden also talked about his energy goals during the final presidential debate.
We have to move toward a net zero emissions. The first place to do that by the year 2035 is in energy production, by 2050, totally.
So how did PolitiFact rate the claim that Pelosi used insider information on this purchase?
They rated that claim mostly false.
That was Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols speaking with Mike Haggerty. Find full versions of all fact checks at politifact.com/California. Next, we'll hear a conversation about fiber optics and the future of internet connectivity on the Central Coast.
And welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chambers weekly series where we take a moment and get to know more about key leaders in our community. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today you'll get to be a part of a particularly timely conversation with Tim Williams, founder and CEO of Digital West. Where are you zooming in from today?
Today, I'm actually in a beautiful town called Genoa, Nevada. It sits in the Eastern Sierras, just below Lake Tahoe in the Carson Valley. It's an area I've been looking at for years, and just how happened this last year with all the insanity, I bought a house up here, and so working remotely has been something no problem with, but I'll even see if I can show you this real quick. I'll just show you. As you know, we've got lots of rain down in San Luis Obispo, and lots of snow have been hidden here, so I don't know if you can see that there. So it's been a beautiful week and something kind of new for me as far as living in the snow, but it's been pretty cool.
Well, so Genoa, Nevada does not sound like an easy commute. How are you? Because I see in slow sometimes too.
Yeah, it's actually, you would think it would be a difficult, it's actually a 7-hour drive, but many people know I'm a pilot. It's actually my passion. I love that as my hobby. And so there's an airport 5 miles from here. and I fly into Santa Maria, which is by the where I live down in the San Luis and Santa Barbara area. And so it's a 1 hour commute. So it's actually pretty nice. I feel very fortunate to be able to do that, but I also enjoy doing it too.
That's so awesome. We saw your photo in our social media posts of you as a pilot right there. And it's amazing and really taking COVID telecommuting to a whole new level. So that's pretty awesome.
Well, and it's a safer way to fly, right? There's nobody in the plane with me. So it's pretty good.
I'd love to take a step back and talk about how you first started up and what initially intrigued you or brought you to the telecom world.
Well, I graduated from Cal Poly as a journalism student. And so, you know, I learned the fine art of journalism and being unbiased and all that good stuff. And then the internet started to take off. And so in the mid 90s, I saw that there was this thing called the internet, and it's kind of a wild west and everyone's going to be utilizing it, and what a cool opportunity. And so I kind of quit the job I had at the time right after college and took a job with a local internet provider called FixNet. And they were a local dial-up access company. And I just did it to immerse myself in it. And I did, and I just loved it. I saw what the potential was. We were getting homeowners and local community members onto this internet, which was just starting to go. And I became the general manager within about 6 months because I just swallowed it. I just absorbed it. It was great. And so after a while, I kind of saw the real need for the commercial side of this, that how do I really get these businesses, what the world wants to see, we want to see the content. And so how can I focus on those content meters? And so I ended up starting Digital West really about February 1999, so almost exactly 22 years ago. And I was able to start by, you know, start slow, kind of did some internet connectivity for businesses in the community, a lot of web hosting. And one of my first customers was Best Western Hotels. So I housed about 500 websites for them. Some friends, Pacific Leisure Marketing in Pismo Beach, brought that account to me. And I was able to go from there. So I just kept building the company up and still fascinated by it. Still, it was such a neat thing to be able to bring businesses, you know, here's your email, here's your access to connecting. And there was even video conferencing back then. I mean, it was all very, you know, rudimentary, but things were starting to take off. And, you know, another interesting part about it is just San Luis Obispo and the community we live in there. There's a, you know, we have the universities, we have Cuesta, we have a lot of interest. There was a thing called SlowNet that was getting people kind of into the internet. So our community was pretty savvy to some degree, you might say. And so I just tapped into that and said, I'd like to be able to create a larger business-focused internet service provider, which is exactly what I did. And then we were able to work with partners throughout the community to keep growing our business. And we just kept going. And in about 2008, we saw the opportunity to where we could build some fiber optics. And that really was where things were going. You know, the cable modems and the dial-up stuff with DSL was only going so fast. And so we jumped in with some partnerships in the county and started our fiber deployment right around 2009. And just continued to grow and grow it. And we've been a pretty local, well-known local mainstay on the Central Coast for, like I said, 22 years.
Well, I think I want to dig a little into that, because is there something special about the Central Coast? You know, obviously you haven't been here more than a couple years, visited a lot, but didn't know those deep pieces that, you know, telecom companies, there seemed to be a different landscape that had set up back then for the Central Coast. Can you talk a little bit about, is that something that was special to this or new?
Well, yes, there was, and you're hitting it for sure. Aside from not wanting to move, I didn't want to leave the, you know, the place where I loved and called home for my college career and whatnot. We do have a very unique asset in San Luis Obispo County where we have these cable landing stations that are right outside. One in Grover Beach. There's one actually kind of at the end of Foothill. There's a cable landing station that's there in San Luis, and then one in Los Osos. And there's actually a fourth that's just up just on the north side of Morro Bay. And these are locations where these big fat internet cables that go across the ocean through the ocean to the Pacific Rim countries, down all the way into Mexico, across over to Guam, Hawaii, and beyond into Japan and China. So it actually, if you think about it, San Luis Obispo is kind of that mouth, that opening where a lot of this flow of traffic comes into. Now, we don't have giant metropolis here on the Central Coast, thank goodness, but we do have these cables come onto our, through our beaches and then head north and south. And so they go off to the Silicon Valley and down to the Los Angeles area. And so because of that, we do have an unusual amount of fiber in the area, not to be used by the community, but it goes running through here. And we realized if we could be that middle company and tap into it, we could then bring that connectivity to the local businesses and residents. And that's exactly what we did. So we've been able to work with the companies like CenturyLink and Level 3 and Quest and AT&T. And we've worked with them and it's allowed us to build out our network and then just keep growing it throughout the Central Coast.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Digital West Tim Williams. And a note that Digital West is a supporter of KCBX.
And I know you now help lead the Pacific Coast Broadband Consortium. Can you tell us a little bit about the current state of telecom in the region? People probably hear fiber, broadband, all of those things. And maybe don't understand exactly how it all kind of fits and why it's necessary.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so the internet, those of us that have been involved with it for a long time or for a while here, we kind of know that there's almost never enough speed. There's almost never enough reliability. And the more we do things that are in the cloud or the more we're able to work remotely, it really takes that connectivity that we have and makes it extremely important to our business and our way of life. I mean, I'm sure we've all sat at home with our families on a Sunday afternoon and our Sunday evening, and we're all watching a Netflix movie and that little buffer comes out. And you're like, geez, well, that's because a lot of people are doing that at home that particular weekend. And you're in a neighborhood where you're probably the cable provider and they're just not necessarily enough. And so the Pacific Coast Broadband Consortium was developed, and it's a tri-county consortium, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Ventura, to really put some focus on what it is that's going to take to really continue to ramp that up. If we just wait for the incumbents, if we wait for the AT&Ts and the Charters to just build more, we've seen that doesn't necessarily get us there. And they're good partners to have out there, but we don't have a lot of competition. In fact, Digital West is a pretty rare find to see in many other areas. So because I'm involved not only in our region, but nationally with different fiber consortiums and groups and conventions that we'll go to, you don't find a lot of competitive players like us that are full utility that can go out and be on the poles and underground and connect schools and hospitals and businesses. There really aren't a lot. Most places, the vast majority, you've got maybe a cable operator and maybe a good telephone company, and that's pretty much all you got. So your choice is very limited. And the Broadband Consortium's goal is, how can we do things? How can we help set policy? How can we set the direction of a community so that there is an opportunity to have more competition that will be building fiber optics and get that out there? So that consortium has been helpful. I've been involved in it since the beginning. So I do a lot of work down in Ventura and Santa Barbara for that. And I think, I think our community, since our county population-wise is the smaller of the three, we definitely have some great assets here. And cable landing stations are one thing, but we do have, our county is actually very open to how can we help expand this. There's actually the chamber will put out a link. There's going to be a broadband summit we're starting. I think it's on the 18th and 25th of February, somewhere on those dates. And so those conversations are happening. And I think that's going to help get us to where we can utilize existing assets. We don't have to always dig up the streets. We can work together in certain areas. And that's really what Digital West has done, is built these great relationships with the cities and the counties. So, because we're not going to compete with them, we want to work together with them. So we're almost always going after a public-private partnership to put something together that's a win for that entity and a win for Digital West. And so anyway, that's what we've been doing. And I think it's been pretty successful, and we've got a lot more to do.
Well, what I would say is exactly, you brought up the point, which was interesting. There aren't a lot of Digital Wests out there. In fact, when I got here, I wasn't familiar with what a Digital West was. And it does seem to be dominated by those big multinational corps. So in talking about that, why do you think it's important that we have some choice, some options when it comes to kind of that internet telecom provider?
Well, this goes back to something that's kind of core to me and to my business partner, Jeff Buckingham. You know, Jeff's been always in the competitive telecom industry for so long. And I'll go back into the 80s. I mean, this is when that started. It was just that the big companies become so large, they really are the monopoly, but we needed them. We needed that monopoly because without it, who's going to run, you know, telephone wire? Who's going to run cable wire? And so these companies come in and do that. But if there's no competition, like we see, you know, in certain governments and things like that, if there isn't competition, it doesn't necessarily mean that the best rise to the top. And so customer service may not be as great. Pricing may not be as great. And so when the telecom industry said, we can establish a competitive telecom industry, that opened up the opportunity for businesses to come along and utilize some of the existing assets, but then provide a better service or try and provide a better service, maybe better pricing, maybe better customer interaction. And Jeff's been successful with that for decades. And that has kind of carried over into, well, fiber optics is part of that communication medium. And so we've been providing fiber optics. All the other guys can too, but they just don't seem to deploy it as much. And they're not doing it because there's no one enticed to do. There's no, without the competition, there's no incentive for change. And so in some ways we're zealots for competition. And we like that idea of being in there to come out here and say, listen, we know we can get this done. And if we do this and we do it well, they're probably going to compete with us and they're much larger than us. We just need to tell the right story to say, hey, they wouldn't have done it if we didn't come and try to do some of this. And by the way, we're your local company. We want to keep working with you. So it's a balancing act. And we also work in partnership with the big carriers as well. So, but that's kind of the competitive side. Once you get competition in the market, it really, the consumer always benefits it. And what's different is I can go buy shoes at one store, buy shoes at another store. I can make the decision on that. It's hard with a utility. You can't just go to another power company or just go to another cable operator because that's not the way that industry is laid out. So we've done a lot of hard work to make it so that we can be a competitive connectivity carrier. And so we just do fiber optics and it's what we do well. And so we are going to continue to grow that.
That was Tim Williams of Digital West speaking to the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona. Finally today, Around Downtown is a monthly series here on Issues and Ideas that explores the concept of downtown and what challenges and possibilities face a community while it strives to keep its downtown vibrant. Here's host Bettina Swigger.
I have two wonderful guests with me today, and our listeners will get to hear about the retail experience from a maker's perspective in stores that are located in San Luis Obispo, in Santa Barbara, in Ojai, and beyond. So joining me today, I have Jenny Compolt and Amy Cooper. Welcome. Amy, let's hear from you first.
I'm actually in Santa Barbara where I live. I've lived here over 25 years now. And I worked in writing, copywriting and editing for some catalog companies in town and had my own writing business and ended up being a brand manager for a clothing company here in town. And that inspired me. You know, if I was going to work that hard for someone else, I thought, you know, I think it's time to try working that hard just for myself. And I opened my own retail business, Plum Goods, in Santa Barbara, right on State Street in 2010. So that was the first time I owned a store, was a buyer, but it was so related to all the different skill sets I've used in my previous careers and just recently closed due to the pandemic, which was heartbreaking, but also freed me up to take all that I learned and help other businesses. So I was able to help two women who were opening a store in Ojai that just opened last fall, a brand new retail experience, which is doing really well. And then I was tapped by the Junk Girls to come and work with them and help them on their buying and branding and all the different aspects of that is the Junk Girls. So I have a mixed experience in retail and marketing and branding and merchandising and buying in multiple areas in California.
How remarkable that you were able to take a bit of heartbreak and turn it into service to other people.
Yeah, that was quite a bit of heartbreak, but I did learn a lot. I mean, it's like going to graduate school, having your own retail business for that long. So I learned a lot about buying, a lot about makers, met a lot of incredible makers. What a joy for me to have a platform to celebrate what I love the most, which is makers and artists and handmade and recycled and upcycled.
And the Junk Girls are Jenny, who we have with us today, and her partner, Melissa.
So Junk Girls has been basically in business, I would say, since 2009, with retail since about 2014. We've been in the downtown locations for about 2.5 years. That's downtown SLO in the old Museo marketplace space, as well as had a store in and gallery in Cambria for about 2.5 years. So prior to that, a lot in the wholesale area, as well as shows. And I also do large format art that is in placed in some stadiums and such. Prior to Junk Girls, I was the creative director for Netflix. I was also in marketing for eBay and have owned several design firms, also one that did a lot of work to benefit nonprofits. So a varied background in creative specifically, also marketing and branding. But Junk Girls is really near and dear to my heart because it is a byproduct of art therapy for me, which was important as a healing in my journey, as well as what we give out and hopefully share to others.
And there are two lively parklets across the road from you. Have you noticed an impact because of the outdoor dining that's taking place there?
Oh, I think that it's fantastic that they're there. And the parklets, the restaurants, they definitely drive the traffic. It's a very strolling street. Both Higuera and Monterey are strolling streets. People spend time in the mission. I mean, we're in an incredible location. We hear a lot from people that there's lots to do and lots to see on these streets. And it's when the restaurants had to close again, just lately, we really saw the decrease. And what's fun is a lot of times the restaurants will say, okay, we've got a little bit of a wait. Okay, go see these stores. Junk Girls is over here. And these people come in with their buzzers or their cell phones waiting to get their buzz to come back and get them to their, you know, their outside table. So no, it's a wonderful community.
It's really remarkable to hear about how both of you have such intense corporate backgrounds, and yet you're now working in this sort of smaller scale environment. But I would assume that given the last year, you might be more challenged in these roles than you were in some of those other positions that you've held. Is that true, or am I projecting?
Melissa and I actually started the Junk Girls over the recession, and we both came from a strong background in, you know, obviously the corporate, but also from the startup aspect of that. And when we started it, we knew we wanted to build something that gave back to others, was creative personally. This journey has been great and the different things that we've been able to achieve. But when COVID hit, it was kind of, how do I say it, fun to put our boots back on and say, okay, how do we get through this and still do what we do well and affect people? What we really saw was people really wanting to bond with us and what we're doing and how we are as people as well as makers, which is the epitome of our story. So it was a obviously challenging financial time. We want to really reach out and affect others, affect more people. My background from the art therapy component of what this all started as, and the difficulties I've had, which, you know, subsequently turned into my art and how we portray the store, we've realized that we have more to offer than just being a retail store, which in itself is huge. And we're in an incredible environment and we love it. But it's actually slightly exciting.
So enter Amy. Is that why Amy has come into the situation?
I mean, I know that at Plum Goods, you know, I was doing everything on my own, and it's a lot to run a company and run a business and a retail store and all of that. And the other side was, I'm not a maker. I just am a huge fan of makers. So I'm a buyer. So I'm curating everything. Now I get to go exponentially next level, not only to work with the two makers I most admire on the planet, but get to bring in my buying skills. We've brought in all these new lines, which I think was part of the pandemic silver lining, was like, how can we maximize what we're doing in the store and the floor space and still give the experience. And that's where my brand management comes in, like really a Junk Girls experience, but not have Jenny and Melissa and their makers have to make every single thing. We want to inspire imagination and creativity. And so everything I was trying to do at Plum, they're doing there. So now we get to all work together as a team, which is super satisfying.
Yeah. And to that point, Amy, you have always been a mentor to me and to Melissa. We've known Amy's store, Plum Goods. We've our number one wholesale account. and has been or had been since Amy needed to close. So it was very organic how we kind of came together, because we were looking at how can we take and continue to move this forward. And then having Amy in the position that she could do something positive, we decided this in August and sort of put together what roles and responsibilities were, with me being much more open to make and create. But then, like she was saying, it peppered in all these other makers that we gave a chance to. I mean, there's people who weren't able to do the stores, weren't able to do the trade shows, weren't able to do things that now we were buying their products. And it was really what Melissa and I have wanted the Junk Girls to become, where we're a good brand umbrella for makers that we curate and really enjoy. So Amy amplified that.
It seems to me that this whole experience and this personal connection that you're having with your makers and the buying of materials that are made by individuals is kind of counter to a lot of the narrative that we hear about retail environment, right? Brick and mortar stores are, of course, sort of imperiled, can be the narrative. And nothing has made that more clear than the pandemic. However, while we have we can buy anything we want at the click of a button, I feel like your brand is personifying this idea of developing a relationship with the person who's making the item that you're buying. Was that a conscientious choice? Do you think that's a reaction to what's happening societally?
This is something that Melissa and I have always wanted to do, to give back, to allow other makers to express. This has been a very, very trying year for everybody. Anybody in retail has been exhausting.
It was so personal for Jenny to start making out of her own, you know, art therapy. So the very essence of the Junk Girls is the maker behind the product. But then the other side of that is that I really believe, and I've seen in the trends since I've been in business and in retail, is that everybody wants experiential, because you can get things online that you could get at a chain, but what you can't get is an experience. So there's always going to be a need for those special places that you want to walk in. Going online, there's so much there, and or either you're going very targeted for what you think you want. But when you walk into a store that you love, or like going to a restaurant, a new restaurant, or seeing a play or a movie or anything like that, you're having an experience of something new. So that sense of discovery is so important. I don't see experiential retail going anywhere. And in fact, I've seen through the pandemic, all of the different stores I work with that have this really special experience have all done very, very well.
And Amy, you have experience in Ojai, in Santa Barbara, and in San Luis Obispo. All of these are tourist communities, mm-hmm. I would say.
Yep.
How has that affected the work?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we're all three very lucky, because, you know, you tend to shop when you're on vacation. You want to walk around, you want to go have lunch, have a glass of wine, and go shopping. And so those destination areas are the places, and including my Los Angeles rep who works all up and down California said her stores that are doing really well are all based in destination-based areas. So those places that have beautiful downtowns like SLO, the beautiful brickwork, the buildings, Santa Barbara's State Street is gorgeous. Ojai is a beautiful downtown. So people will do their day trips and come there and walk around, and those stores do really well.
Yeah. And I think we're also uniquely situated differently from other downtowns that might have a lot of office culture, right? We don't have these towering skyscrapers that are devoid of office workers coming in and providing the foot traffic. So we may recover faster than some of the other metropolitan areas.
Your residential community is so passionate about their downtown, your farmers market, all the different things you've done in your downtown. There's just an incredible level of support for downtown SLO I've seen from both tourists, of course, but locals as well.
I've heard you both talk about the idea of the experience that you have both online and in the shop. Jenny, I remember talking to you in, gosh, probably fall of 2019 about some of the workshops and classes you had started doing in this space. Is there any talk about bringing some of those activities back?
Absolutely. That is really important. The whole maker aspect of in participation is really fun. We'll definitely be bringing back those workshops. San Luis Obispo special, and people are coming to San Luis Obispo, and that is fabulous.
That was Bettina Swigger of Downtown SLO speaking with Jenny Compolt of the Junk Girls and Amy Cooper of the former Plum Goods in Santa Barbara. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.